Welcome to CrimeWire, an elite team of veteran investigation experts, along with noted crime consultants and attorneys, often featured on the popular news programs for families of violent crime to find answers and seek justice. The CrimeWire team, Denny Griffin, retired investigator and author, and Susan Murphy Milano, violence expert and author, are there, on top of the crime, at the top of their game. CrimeWire is the place for information, news, safety, and most importantly, justice. Our interactive website is www.crimewiresite.com. You can call in anytime during tonight's show. The number is 646-478-0982. And remember, you can participate in tonight's program simply by going to the live interactive chat room here on Block Talk Radio. If you are a friend or family member and would like to send the CrimeWire team information on an unsolved or suspicious death case, or want to be considered for a segment on a case for a future show, email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com. As you know, my friend and co-host Susan Murphy Milano has been diagnosed with stage 4 cancer and will be off for the next several weeks while she undergoes treatment. You can show your support for Susan and keep up with her progress by visiting her site at www.conqueringcancer.me. On last week's show, we began a discussion of the Isabel Celis case, and we'll continue that conversation tonight. For those who weren't with us last week, I'll provide a brief synopsis of the case. On Saturday morning, April 21, 2012, Sergio Celis called police in Tucson, Arizona, to report that his six-year-old daughter, Isabel, had vanished from her bedroom overnight. 4 months later, Isabel remains missing. Sergio and his wife, Rebecca, remained silent in the beginning of the investigation, but later agreed to speak out about their daughter's disappearance. Much can be gleaned from their statements to the press. Blood evidence was found in the Celis house, and Sergio has been restricted from seeing his other children and family. But as of now, no arrests have been made, and Isabel's whereabouts remain unknown. Although there are many theories floating around regarding possible human trafficking, sexual assault, and speculation as to whom the kidnappers could be, there seems to be nothing in the way of concrete evidence to lead authorities to the answers they need. CrimeWire consultant, statement analyst Peter Hyatt is back to share his thoughts as to what happened to Isabel. But first, we want to spend a few minutes on recent developments involving seven-time Tour de France winner Lance Armstrong. Peter, welcome back to CrimeWire.
Hi, Danny. Thanks for having me back again.
And why don't we start with the Lance Armstrong situation? You can tell us, maybe you want to start just for the listeners who don't know as to who Lance Armstrong is and what's been going on with him.
Lance Armstrong was a cancer survivor from the early 90s who had what began with, I guess, testicular cancer, and it spread throughout his body, and from what I could understand from how it looked medically, he wasn't going to survive it. He was a promising young cyclist. He had, I think, competed in one stage of the Tour de France going way back into the 90s. To everyone's surprise, he survived the cancer and went on to become almost an entity unto himself, where he won record-setting seven Tour de France wins, which is probably the most grueling sport that exists. The Tour de France, most human punishing sport that I can think of. And in those seven victories, he began the Lance Armstrong Foundation and the Live Strong yellow wristbands, and the numbers of the money that he generated and produced. Perhaps $1 billion would be not an exaggeration. I don't know the exact dollars, but he became a huge, almost a corporation unto himself. And he had been dogged by allegations of blood doping and using exogenous testosterone, some anti-cancer medications, some anti-estrogen medications to counterbalance the extra testosterone he was using, that sort of thing. And the news of this past week is that he has always fought against these allegations. He's the most, or he claims to be the most tested athlete who has never failed a test in his life. that no one has been had his blood or urine tested more times than Lance Armstrong, and he claims he's never failed a single test. And but this past week, he decided not to fight the USADA, the American arm that investigates sports, drug use in sports. And personally, Vinny, I have been a big fan of Lance Armstrong, especially back in 1999 and 2000. My sons and I watched the Tour de France religiously and took up cycling and was just really inspired by him and loved his work ethic and his attitude and everything else. But when the when he finally took to the airways to defend himself, the simplest thing that anyone can say regarding an allegation, if they're innocent, is they will say, I didn't do it. I didn't blood dope. I didn't take testosterone. I didn't cheat into any of those things. And what I noticed first going back a number of years is that Lance Armstrong consistently avoided saying those words. In the free editing process, we call it, is when someone speaks for themselves, that they're not having a prepared statement. They are not memorizing a script. They're speaking extemporaneously. They're speaking for themselves. And at the moment, at the second, they're choosing their own words. Statement analysis teaches that a person who didn't do it, whether it be an assault, a robbery, drug use, or anything, will not often even wait to be asked if they did it. They'll say, I didn't do it. They'll use the pronoun I. They'll link themselves to it with the past tense. And they'll specify what it is they didn't do. Lance never did. Lance never linked himself to what we call reliable denial. And he pointed to the number of drug tests that he passed, which I liken to this. If you were to ask me if I ever robbed a bank, I would say I never robbed a bank. And then if you were to ask me specifically, did you rob your bank last Tuesday? And I say, Denny, you're asking me if I robbed the bank last Tuesday. Let me tell you, I have gone to my bank once a week, 52 weeks a year, for 5 years. That's 250 times. I have never once been seen stealing anything in those 250 times. And after a while, you'd say, Peter, you're avoiding the question. Did you steal from the bank last Tuesday? And I say, Denny, I would never steal from a bank. How can you ask me that? And then you'd say, Peter, you've avoided the question again. And then taking the role of Lance Armstrong, I'd say, well, you're just embittered and jealous and envious. You're a has-been. You never went anywhere. And so what's happened over the years is that as people have spoken and come forward to say, I saw him blood dope. I saw him inject. I saw him. In fact, he commanded that his team do it, and he was the one that even brought the drugs, pulled over on the side of a road of a mountain where no one could see us, and we all had to do this. Lance Armstrong would attack them, and his people, his PR people and his lawyers would go after them. One of his teammates, Frankie Andreo, his wife, had given testimony that about what Lance had said he had taken, including testosterone. The cancer drug EPO, which raises the red blood count, which makes you like a fresh athlete, you know. She had heard all these things, and she was terribly smeared. The U.S. champion from long ago, Greg LeMond from the 80s, he was smeared by Armstrong. Other cyclists who have spoken out and said that they saw him do it have found their contracts not renewed, their team cut from the Tour de France listings or other various races where their team was uninvited suddenly because of these sort of things. And so there's always been this very heavy, dark cloud over him. Well, his blood tests that were clean in 1999 and 2000 apparently are not clean. It's just that in 1999 and 2000, they did not have the mechanism to test for EPO that they have now. So the same samples, blood and urine samples from 1999 and 2000, blood or urine, now have tested positive for the presence of EPO. He associated with and paid a great deal of money for a doctor who was indicted for peddling drugs, known to be a drug doctor. And there was a lot of sophisticated masking agents and masking attempts that are done in these sports. We have testimony that Armstrong bribed a cycling federation There's testimony that he was given before a test, he was given 20 minutes to prepare himself and to do whatever manipulations that we needed. So we have all those things that came down, but this was different. Armstrong is a fighter. He's a guy who would go nose-to-nose with every opponent. He would challenge them on the mountains. And I had never seen anything like this type of fight in someone so often and so repetitive. So for him to not fight this last charges, there had to be a reason. And we've found out probably what the reason is. The lawyers can fight without a problem the blood testing. They can call it junk science. They can bring in experts, paid experts to contradict it. They can try to confuse people. They can cast doubt upon the chain of custody. We saw a Major League Baseball player tested positive for testosterone. He was suspended from baseball. He appealed. His own statement was ridiculously deceptive, saying, I don't think that I really in my heart put this stuff in my body at any given time. I don't think so. You know, that type of lack of commitment to a statement. So he was deceptive. But his lawyer successfully argued that when the man who worked for Major League Baseball took it home on Friday night and didn't bring it to FedEx until Monday, that he could have tainted it between Friday night and Monday, even though the container had no evidence of being touched. And the guy said, I didn't bring it to FedEx. FedEx was closed at 5 o'clock on Friday. And so Ryan Braun got off on that because of that. So the lawyers weren't afraid of that. And the what was going to make this case different was that there was going to be eyewitness testimony given. 12 people were going to testify against him. They had dealt with many of those people already, ex-teammates, and they were smeared as being has-beens and losers and jealous wannabes and all that. What made this different is what we're hearing now is that George Hincapie is known to be a long-term friend of Lance Armstrong. He was Lance Armstrong's lieutenant in the Peloton, meaning that he took often the headwind for Armstrong so Armstrong could draft behind him to have that extra strength. Hincapie just rode in his 17th straight Tour de France, which is a record, and he was given a great honor by the Peloton. This is just in July. We're now learning that Hincapie, who Armstrong called his best bud and his best friend of the Peloton, Hincapie himself was prepared to give eyewitness testimony. And Lance is on record as having praised Hincapie repeatedly. So it was like the et tu, Brute of the cycling world, where finally Armstrong came to the end of the line where he could mess with this person, he could mess with that person, he could mess with this result, mess with that result, try to cast doubt on everything. But how do I now say that George Hincapie, who is confirming everyone else's testimony, is lying when I've publicly spoken about his integrity and our friendship together? So it appears that Armstrong has reached the end of his rope. I did some statement analysis of Armstrong over the years, and he was found to be deceptive and issuing unreliable denials. But I found in a recent, I think it was a USA Today poll, said that 58% of Americans think that he is just the victim of a witch hunt and that he didn't do it. And I checked in our readership. The last time I checked our poll, the readership of statement analysis, 90% after listening to his words said, no, he didn't. So we have a great disparity, which reminded me a lot of the case we talked about several weeks ago, Charlie Rogers, where the public, by and large, was supportive of this woman donating money to her hate crime report. And the astute readers were saying, no, I think that number was 98% of them said she is deceptive. So readership got that, and the Lance Armstrong case wasn't very different. He did appear to be deceptive, and they caught that. So that's kind of the Lance Armstrong case in a nutshell. But there's one thing, I don't know if we have time to talk about it, but it's the use of the word never. If you were to ask me, Peter, did you ever kill anybody? I would answer you, no, I've never killed anyone, and that would be a truthful statement. If you were to ask me, Peter, did you steal money on Tuesday at 5 p.m., from your employer, And I would say, Denny, I've never stolen money. It would fall into the same category of avoiding the direct question, avoiding the truth. And it is one of the top lies that people will use. Instead of a reliable denial, they'll use the word never. So in some cases, the word never can be truthful. In some cases, it can be a signal of deception. But in all cases, it's considered unreliable unless the word ever is asked. So Lance Armstrong did say, I have never doped. I have also never tested positive, he said. Well, Marion Jones, the runner, said the same thing. I have never doped, and she went to prison for doping. There's another famous guy on television. I'm not sure if you would recognize this name, but he said his name was Joey Buttafuoco, and he said, I never slept with Amy Fisher in my life, with my New York accent. And he obviously went to jail also for it. So the word never cannot be accepted as reliable when it is a substitute for did not or didn't. So the conclusion of the matter is that Lance Armstrong did blood dope, did use testosterone, did use Clenbuterol, he did use EPO, and the other things that apparently the eyewitnesses have said. Yet the American public, I think, just wants to look the other way, which is kind of like us lately. So that's the story in a nutshell. It's a very sad story to me.
Well, I can't help it. There's two more things I want to talk about Armstrong, but one of the things I wanted to ask, I couldn't help when you mentioned the word never, using the word never, and I don't want to get off into a political discussion here, but it is the political season, and I remember several years ago there was a politician who used the word never. I never had sex. And did you happen to hear that statement? And if so, was that that fall into that category about using never?
Do you remember the shortly afterwards, the black eye that he had on came out on the White House front lawn with the black eye? And it was said that he said that he got that black eye from his daughter. But we kind of assumed that his wife didn't share the same personal internal subjective dictionary about the meaning of sexual relations that he had. So the number one lie in court is I don't recall, I don't remember. That's Ekman says that's the number one lie that people use in court. I don't remember, I don't recall. That's in court. What I'm finding is, and I need a little more research, but the number one lie in a denial is the word never. And so although it can be used truthfully, what we do is we deem it as being unreliable, meaning that we need, you know, it's okay for me to say, Denny, I did not steal from the bank on Tuesday. In fact, I've never stolen. That would be a reliable denial because I've used the first person singular and the past tense, and I've addressed the issue. Then I can add on, if I'd like to, I've never stolen. I've never used drugs. I've never killed a person. Those can be all truthful statements if they are part of an overall truthful statement. But by themselves, they are not reliable. And I don't know, and if listeners can give me some suggestions. Denny, I have a really good grip on the psychology behind statement analysis. I really understand how it works and why it works the way it does. But I'm not sure why the word never is easier on a liar than other words. Why is it easier to say, hey, I never did that, where the same person won't say, I didn't do that? So if anyone has I'm open to suggestions. I'd like to hear some opinions on that one.
Well, see if we get any callers or anybody out of the chat room. Kim isn't with us tonight. She's had the night off, so I'm going back and forth between the chat room and the switchboard here. So when I get a chance, I'll check and see if anybody's offered any suggestions. The other thing about now, and this isn't really with the deception issue or the lying on the part of Armstrong, but now that he's decided not to fight the allegations any longer, I'm gathering he can be stripped of his titles or some of his victories. And I don't know, I'm just curious, would would that automatically then, if he is disqualified, would the second place person automatically be awarded that trophy or that the victory in that case? I don't know how that works. Would it automatically go to the second place finisher?
That's how it should work, and apparently it's not how it's panning out here, because the second place finisher in some of the tours, for instance, himself had been banned for using banned substances and for drugs. There are some people that say that in the peloton, in the large, I don't know, 195 when it starts, 196 cyclists that start that three-week race, and I think it ends up being about 170 racers at the end because men just drop out. It's so brutal. People believe that everyone uses or almost everyone uses and they can't compete without it. I don't know if that's true. I do know that every big name in sports of recent years in sports, of the cycling sport, seems to be indicted one way or another or associated with the blood doping and everything else. What some people are also saying is that the USADA was on a witch hunt, and there's no doubt there was personal animosity between the board members of the USADA and Armstrong. Interesting, when Armstrong filed a brief to shut them down in court, the judge chided somewhat the USADA for their tactics, but the judge slammed Armstrong's lawyers, saying that this was supposed to be a statement on why this case should be shut down. Instead, it's a long-winded manifesto on all of his accomplishments. To me, that is deceptive. You're supposed to give me an argument on why this should not go forward, and what you're doing is you're trying to appeal to his history in cycling. You're trying to appeal to cancer. You're trying to appeal to the United States versus France and that sort of thing. When we have a need to divert, there's something already wrong. And this is the point about deception. When someone, you must, in order to do analysis, you must be able to place yourself into the situation tainted with innocence. People like to say, I'm going to go into this investigation with a completely neutral mind, and that's actually not how we do analysis. We actually presuppose someone to be innocent, and then we are ready to hear what they have to say. I'll give you an example. We had a case where had a brutal rape case came in a report, and it had just come in. An officer had responded on the scene of a young male who had claimed to have been brutally raped by an older male who was working there at the place where he was. And right away, there's a certain panic that goes through people when they hear this. And the officer said, I even have a neighbor in the apartment building who overheard this. This is how bad it is. So the officer called me and said, I've already interviewed the victim. I had just come on. His partner had interviewed the victim in the late overnight shift, got off work. The victim is completely credible. This is a horrible case. The accused is at his job now. We're going to interview him before we arrest him. And we're going to do a joint interview with you, meaning me. Would you set that up and set it up fast? And I said, okay, but he is about 2 hours drive from me, and the officer said, just set it up as fast as you can. We want to get on this thing. And I said, fine, I'll do that. The alleged perpetrator, I reached him by phone. He knew why I was calling, because someone had already called his place of work, and it turned into kind of a gossip fest among several of the secretaries. It had spread around quickly within just a few moments. And I grant that I live in a state of not a heavy population. So he knew what the accusation was. And he said to me, I didn't do it. I didn't rape him. Oh my God, are you effing kidding me? I would never do such a thing. And I know that without being asked, that he didn't do it. because he owned it. He said things that someone who did it wouldn't say. Yes, he did say I wouldn't do it, but the first thing he said was, I didn't rape him. I didn't rape anybody. Oh, my God, I've never, you know, that sort of thing. So what I did was, I like to be efficient in my work, and I work hard, so I have to kind of manage my time well. So I set up the interview for later that afternoon. And I called back the officer. I said, it's set up for later in the afternoon. And he blew up at me. Oh, are you kidding me? This has got to be done now. What are you doing? And I said to him, where are you? He said, I'm on my way to the hospital with the victim now. We're going for the testing. And I said, I will wager you a cup of coffee that either the test is negative or that he won't go through with it because it didn't happen. Well, how do you know that? I said, because he told me. Oh, the rapist told you, huh? That's how you know. He really was in quite a stir there with in terms of mocking me. But Vinny, this is the confidence I have in the system. I said, well, I'll tell you what, if the rape test shows that he's been raped and he actually goes through with it, call me right back and I'll have this guy there at ASAP. I'll get in my car now. And so 15, 20 minutes go by. He called back and he said he bailed out. He recanted and it didn't happen. How did you know that? And I spoke to him a little bit about it. He's like, yeah, I remember something that years ago in the retraining I had and something about nouns and verbs, but I don't know what it was. And that type of ignorance drives me out of my mind. I did not need to follow through and drive for 4 hours, a round trip for an interview that was unnecessary, simply for that reason. So I am watch carefully over my time, make it an economy of time. But that is the type of confidence. I would have gone through with the interview had it been necessary. But I knew that from this man's statement, he said it early, he said it often, he said it without sensitivity indicators or qualifiers. He just said it. It obviously was sensitive in the sense that he had never been accused of something so horrific before. And he was later on stunned when he's like, how did you know I was telling the truth? And that sort of thing. But that is how well the system serves me. It's just an amazing thing. Lance Armstrong could not bring himself to say, I did not dope. I did not inject myself with testosterone. So therefore, I'm not allowed to say it for him. I can. We had a case where an officer of a much more intelligent, well-trained officer had contacted me and said, what do you have the husband statement, what do you make of the husband statement? And she had the wife statement, and she was going to fax it over to me for analysis. And I said, well, I'll tell you what, according to the statement that you've sent me, this is a very violent relationship between the husband and wife. So they got a lot of problems. And she said, what do you mean? They're both denying there was any violence in the house. And I said, because of the way he introduced her in the statement, it follows the same rules of society. Someone says, my wife, Heather, it's indicative of a good relationship. He's taking ownership with the word my. He's giving her the title of wife. And he's using her name. And then after that, in the law of economy, he'll shorten it to Heather or to my wife or even a term of endearment. In this fellow's statement, he mentioned her first as the wife and then later on by her first name only. He never calls her my wife. It's indicative of a bad relationship. So the officer said, oh, no, you're really wrong in this time because I have her statement right before me, and I'll fax it to you and I'll show you. It, she says, every night when he goes to bed, he says he loves me. And so I chuckled and I said, you have been duped. That is an attempt to persuade. Everyone says to their loved one, good night, I love you. Well, most people do at least. But very few of us have a need to say that to others. When someone has a need to say it in a police statement to an officer investigating domestic violence, they're trying to persuade you. And she got a valuable lesson, and it turned out to be a very bad case where the kids had witnessed quite a bit of violence, and the kids needed to come out of the home, that sort of thing. It was a bad case. So the system, I have that kind of confidence in it. When I, if I were to take a statement from you, and this is how I introduced the Chellis case, if you were to say, I'm here in Las Vegas, and I'm investigating a case here. I'd like to send to you a fax or email of the suspect statement. And I would say to you, that'll be great. Just send the statement and the allegation, but don't give me any other information. And then you say, oh, no, you got to hear about this guy. He is really something else. You got to hear. And I say, no, I don't want to know. All I want to know is what the statement tells me. Let the statement speak, because if someone tells me he's a great guy or he's a bad guy, that could influence me. I'm an emotional creature, as anyone else is. What I want to do is come out and say, in his statement, he has a bad relationship with his wife, because that's what the statement tells me. Or I come out and say, he's not married, and the investigator might say, oh, yes, he is. It's right here in the file. This is his wife. He was married. Here's the marriage certificate. And I would say, no, he's not married in terms of the statement. And that's indicative of a bad relationship. He didn't take ownership of her as a wife. Therefore, to the analyst, he ain't married. And this is not a good thing to be reading. So we look at the statements without any information other than the accusation. And the reason we need the accusation is because we have to need to know what he's answering to. So with Lance Armstrong, for instance, all I'd want to know is he's accused of doping and nothing else. Don't tell me that I sat there with my three sons glued to the television cheering him on as he took on Jan Ehrlich of Germany or something like that. That can't be part of the analysis. I did read his book. I was inspired by his book. I loved it. That can't be part of the analysis. I have to step away. And even as we as fathers or grandfathers have certain emotional attachments to our own children and grandchildren, we can't allow that to go into analysis. We can't look at Sergio and Rebecca Chellis and project ourselves into it in that way. There's another way to do it, but not in that way. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay.
I believe it does.
Well, and here's the reason why. In Isabel Chellis was 6 years old, and her father calls police to report that his daughter had been kidnapped. Okay, and that's how it started. So we have a way of looking at 911 calls through the lens of statement analysis and through a checklist that Susan Adams had worked up with another investigator. I'm sorry, I forget his name. She's a former FBI. She now works, I think, in the University of Berkeley system. But she noticed that in domestic homicide calls, that there were certain things that caught the attention of an analyst that were indicators of possible guilt. Now, not one single indicator should be, oh, this guy is definitely a guilty caller because of such and such. No, they're just a bunch of signs to be investigated. One of the things that she noted was in many guilty callers, in other words, someone who calls 911 who has guilty knowledge of the death of someone in the household, many of those calls began with a greeting. Hello, how are you? Tiffany Hartley, when she called 911 to report her husband supposedly missing, began with a greeting. Innocent callers who have no knowledge of their child's disappearance, who have no knowledge of the loved one's death, they don't take the time to make small talk. They don't start with a greeting. She also noticed in her observations that they ask for help, but not often for the victim. They often ask for help for themselves. So that's something else we look out for. They often use softer language than is applicable to the particular call that they're making. If someone stabbed my wife, it would be, some bastard did this to my wife, and there would be a certain level of anger and rage. I wouldn't say, some gentleman plunged his knife into my wife's stomach. I wouldn't call him a gentleman. So we look for a congruency, and this is where we get to the interesting part about analysis. What we have to do is presuppose that the caller is innocent and the people are innocent. So if I get past the 911 call for now, and I'll get back to that because it's fascinating, but just in this particular case, they reported their daughter was missing. Literally, they reported that she was abducted. We have an abduction. The call began with a greeting, "Hello, we have an abduction." And so the operator naturally said, "What makes you think you have an abduction or kidnapping?" And he said, "I don't have a clue. I don't know why." So that, you know, it's problematic. But now they make this report. Someone has their child. What's the first thing that a parent will do, no matter how bad the panic is, no matter how upset they are, no matter how in absolute trauma they are? They will call out for the child. Like a child missing in the woods, they will call out the child's name. And so when someone is kidnapped, the police will take the torn-apart parents, bring them to a microphone, and have them address the kidnapper, repeatedly using the child's name to personalize the child, to get the kidnapper or abductor to see the child not as a bargaining chip, not as a sex item, but as a human being. And so the police went to Sergio and Rebecca, and they said, "Come now to the microphones, and the media, we'll call the media in, and we'll set it up for you. We'll even help you speak to them." And the parents said no. And the entire day went on. They were looking for her everywhere. That night, they went and they to the parents. They said, "Let us set it up now. How about tomorrow morning?" No. Okay, the next day came. They went to the parents and they said, "You know, this is a critical period of time. This is the clock is ticking. When the 48 hours are going by, we've got to get a message to the abductors. You've got to." They wouldn't speak. And after 4 days, it became apparent to them that, this is what they said later, these parents had no urgency. There was no need. When the parents finally did speak, they told media that they were advised by the police not to speak. They didn't want to interfere with the investigation or something. That's the same thing that Justin DiPietro, missing baby Ayla, said. It's the same thing that Deborah Bradley with baby Lisa said. And it's a terrible sign. They're lying against the very people that they supposedly were to help them. When they spoke, we, the audience, knew why they didn't want to speak. And they were immediately indicated for deception, immediately. And here's why. The mother of a missing child, for example, going all the way back to Solomonic wisdom, when Solomon was able to point out a mother's maternal instinct and how she was created for the purpose of this superior emotional capacity that she has for childbearing and love. A mother bear robs her whelps. Better stay out of her way. It's just a dangerous thing, the mother with her cubs. Well, so it is a mother of a human child. Is women have incredible strength when their child is threatened. And it is personal, it is up close, and it is everything to them. So the first thing out of a mother's mouth is the word "I." I want to speak to my daughter, Isabel. I miss you. I love you. We'll find you. To the person that has her. Isabel is a wonderful little girl, and just talking about it like that. The first thing out of this mother's mouth was "we." We. And that was a very strong signal that something was just as wrong as it was with the behavioral analysis of the parents not coming out. So, but even if we discount all these things, they decided to give an interview on television. And I don't remember the name of the program here. Let me look it up here. They were going to give an interview. And this is the interesting part. They went on the Today Show on May 4th of 2012. This is what we ask people to do. And Denny, I ask you the same thing. You and your wife are reporting that your grandchild was kidnapped out of your home the night before or last week, whatever, and you're going to get on the show. What words would we expect to hear from you? And this is the actual pre-analysis that's done. We expect to hear the word kidnapped or taken or abducted. We expect to hear the word search. We expect to hear the word find. these are the words that we would expect to hear from parents who are going to talk about their abducted child. Is that fair to say?
I believe it is, yes.
Does it sound rational?
Yeah, that's, yes.
Does it in any way, shape, or form sound in any way unfair or just unusual?
No, my thought would be if this is allegedly an abduction that, or a kidnapping, that would be clarified in their statement and their interview. And, yes, that there's a search underway or a search needs to be done or something along those lines.
If you hit a home run and it won the World Series and you were going to be on David Letterman that night for winning the World Series, you're probably going to talk about the home run and the World Series and what it was like. If you won the lottery and you have $200 million in your pocket and you're giving an interview, you're probably going to talk about money and the lottery and what you're going to buy and what you're going to do with the money, that sort of thing. It's very expected. It's very natural. And what we did was we presuppose that Rebecca and Sergio are going to tell the truth, and they're going to talk about how she was taken or kidnapped or abducted, and we've got to find her, and we're going to look for her, and we'll search for her, and we will, you know, that sort of thing, just natural things. Well, in the interview, the word taken was used zero times. The word kidnapped by them was used zero times. The word find, regarding finding Isabel, was used zero times. The word look, when it talks about looking for her, was also never used. And the word search was never used. It was as if they did everything they could to distance themselves from the report that they had made. They did not mention any, they didn't use those words once. They couldn't have done a better job of dislocating themselves from an abduction than they did. When they went on to speak, of course, the analyst is now being hit with this unexpected information. Where is the word kidnapped? Where is the word abducted? Where is the word searching? Where is the word find? Where is all the things I expected? They're not here. What are they talking about? And what they talked about was rather concerning. They talked about her hair, and they talked about her makeup, and they talked about her nails. The father was asked, you know, what do you say to people when they say you did this, that you're involved? How would you answer that? And he gave an answer like, golly gee, it's really something that we just really need to think about. And what? The question was, are you involved in your daughter's kidnapping? Are you involved in your daughter's death? Are you involved in any of these things? And he says, well, we have to really give thought and golly gee type of answer. He avoided giving a direct answer, and that really, I think, if anyone was on the fence about whether this family was involved or not, I think that was probably the last straw of all of it. So.
It's certainly bizarre conduct. I'm trying, sitting here listening to this, trying to think of how you could go through a whole interview about your supposedly kidnapped daughter and never use any of those words. It just is it's bizarre.
Here's a direct quote. Sergio, let me ask you this question. What do you want to say about questions about whether you had anything to do with your daughter's disappearance? I think it's a good question. I word it sometimes. I say, how do you speak to it? What I don't want to say is, people say you did it. And then someone says, I didn't do it, just reflecting my words. I want them to be able to put it into their own words. And I've actually had some merry-go-round issues where someone would say to me, didn't do it. And I would say, didn't do what? Didn't do what you said. What did I say? You know. No, I don't know. You tell me. And I would give every opportunity under the sun for them to say, I didn't do, and then to name what they did, what they didn't do. And if after the end of the interview, 30 minutes, 60 minutes, 2 hours, 5 hours sometimes, and for some people years, where they many interviews, if they can't bring themselves to say it, if they were to listen to this broadcast and tomorrow morning Lance Armstrong were to take the microphone and say, I did not dope, it wouldn't be reliable after all these years. Remember the case of missing 13-year-old Haley Dunn? That was a terribly sad case where there was a mother went on Nancy Grace's show and she got caught lying and her boyfriend was caught lying and they failed their polygraphs and they tried to fool the polygraphers by drugging. They had child pornography, bestiality, bloodlust, drugs, violence, the love of violence, sadism, and all these things. This poor little girl had no shot living with these two monsters, a mother and a boyfriend. In the boyfriend, he refused to take a polygraph at first, and then she talked him into it, and she drugged him, and so they canceled that one, and then later on he went back and failed it. And then his mother insisted that he was innocent, so she paid for a private polygrapher. The public wasn't supposed to know about this. He failed the private polygrapher that the lawyer had hired. So they knew they had a dead girl on their hands, and there's still no arrest to this day, which it baffles me to no end. But they, in all the interviews that he gave, and actually both of them, they both did, but in his, that I'm focusing on, interview after interview, he could never bring himself to say, I didn't do it, even after reading the analysis. He read the analysis and was angry about it, and they had gotten an attorney, she had gotten an attorney, a real crazy, crazy guy who had a checkered history of his own, including drugs, OUI. He had killed a woman behind the vehicle, and in that small town, somehow or another, he was able to say that she was the drunken one, and she was cremated without her body being tested for the blood alcohol. And so he got off with a slap of the wrist. He had gone on television and said, regarding me, he said, only a fool would say the things he's going to say. He's going to meet Texas justice. We're going to bring him here, and we're going to sue him, and we're going to make him answer for things. And I was listening to this thinking, wow, there's quite a number of prominent television attorneys who would love to get the free publicity of this case, and if they're going to ask me questions, they're going to have to take the stand themselves, and that is quite a bonanza, and law enforcement will be up and down cheering. And the attorney that called me a fool shortly afterwards, I don't know if it was a week or two, was apparently having an affair with a cop's wife. Another Texas Ranger pulled up. He jumped out of his car, high on coke or alcohol, and pointed a 9mm pistol at the Texas Ranger's head and lived to tell about it.
Wow.
So in his personal subjective internal dictionary, I'm a fool. I would hate to know or love to find out what an idiot is in his personal dictionary. So it takes it pretty far there.
But I would say
I'm sorry.
I was just wondering, you know, you were speaking about no arrests made in the other case. What do you think, if you want to hazard a guess, is going on with Isabel's case here? Do you think, did the police see what you see? In other words, as far as the deception and the indicators, and what do you think is happening? What do you think is going on in the minds of the investigators?
Sure, and I think that's a good question. They know who did it. They're not sure how they did it, but it's not a mystery. They're not running around going, who did this? This is crazy. They know that Sergio and his wife are involved. I believe at this point they think that it was simply Sergio and then the wife covering up. Because she was also deceptive in her interview. She was deceptive in she actually sounded like she was scripted on the 911 call. But they know, and I think the question for them is a little bit different than the baby Lisa and the baby Ayla case. I think that they are so desperate to find that body that I don't know if it's the Casey Anthony effect, where prosecutors are afraid that there's enough doubt in dumbed-down juries that they'll skate. They had enough information on the father that he agreed to a no-contact working agreement with between them and Shop Technical Services. What that meant was he signed a paper that for whatever 90 days or 120 days or whatever it was, I don't know the length of it, is that he would agree to have no contact with his sons, not even supervised visitation. Now, I can tell you from my years in child protective world is that the only people that get no contact are the ones that pose such an incredible danger that they can't even have supervised visitation. Even pedophiles get supervised visitation. Josh Powell had supervised visitation, and he still was able to kill the boys. So whatever they had on Sergio was so severe that he agreed to it rather than allowing a judge to hear it in an ex parte or actually in a court room where they would present this evidence. So what he does is he says, okay, you have this, I'll stay away, but you don't take away custody from me and my wife. It's a voluntary agreement. He entered into this agreement. Now, one of the things it told me was the police know that he has attempted to persuade his sons. If you're in a household of kids, and that's me in my life, I will say something like, I woke up and came downstairs. I wouldn't say we woke up because I don't orchestrate everyone waking up. Everyone gets up at different times. I just naturally say I. He would only say we, and there were some things within his statements that really told me this guy is talking to his kids. This guy is putting ideas in their heads, including if you look at the 911 call where he talks about his sons. There is some kind of rehearsal going on. They knew this. So I don't think it's a Baby Lisa case. In Baby Lisa case, there was a cowardly prosecutor who did not want to go up against Joe Tacopina. And if Tacopina was telling the truth that the FBI met with him afterwards, I got to tell you, that does not set well with me. What was the FBI doing with Joe Tacopina? I don't get that. This was not something to arrange a new interview. The interviews have been done already. To me, the Baby Lisa case was a clear-cut case where the mother had killed the child, they had the cadaver hit, they had the phony statements, they had the implausible story. What I was hearing, at least, was that they were very close to getting a confession out of Bradley when Tacopina showed up and shut everything down. That's not the case, as far as I know, with the Cellises, that they've not had anyone rise up and say, I'll put an end to this persecution and I'll take the camera on me. I think that they're probably worried about a jury. I certainly think about it. And I think that we're delaying to find the body. So that's what I think the case is there.
So you're pretty sure that this girl, that Isabel, is probably deceased?
Yes, because the parents told me. The parents have told me through their words. When the parents of a missing child immediately speak about the child in the past tense, it means that they know or believe the child is dead. Now, we can take in factors if the police have disclosed some horrible information. In spite of the natural denial of a mother, for instance, it still could slip into their language. But they did repeatedly. They talked about, I think she was gone maybe 2 weeks, and they talked about moving on with life already. And and having two daughters of my own, I can't even imagine such a thing being said. And so they gave the linguistic indicators that she was deceased, and they did it consistently. And we learned from police that there hasn't been nothing that they've told them that has been horrific. In fact, the police said, no, these people have lied. We didn't tell them anything. We didn't tell them not to talk to you or the media or anything like that. This is all they're doing. So there's that distance between the parents and the police. So the police know, and all I can conclude at this point is that they don't feel they have enough to get past a jury that maybe the Cindy Anthony effect here, where Cindy Anthony was claiming that Kaylee was alive. She knew damn well what she was doing. She was deliberately lying. She knew not only that Kaylee was dead, she knew where Kaylee was buried. But she was deliberately doing that, tainting a future jury pool, entertaining people's doubts, playing on their emotions, because I've had things, situation where I've received quite a dosage of hate mail from people for pronouncing a child to be dead when it's quite plain. I had it with Haley when I first the mother came on and spoke about her in the past tense. I pointed that out, and people were infuriated. The same thing about baby Isla. Before the police released the information, they believed she was dead. Readership knew already. And in this case as well. So people want to believe, oh, yeah, I want to have hope for Haley. I want to have hope for Isabel. I want to have hope for whatever. It sounds good and always makes the realist sound like the bad guy. But it's an emotionalism that is used to taint juries. And I think that the prosecution is probably afraid of that very thing.
You know, Peter, does anybody have a motive? I've read some stuff online about the sex trade and this and that. Have you heard of anything that seems to be kind of a solid or logical or sensible motive for the Sellises to have harmed their daughter?
No. As a matter of fact, I think that probably someone close to the family may have helped fuel that type of rumor. It was the same thing that Clint Dunn had wanted to believe. He knew his daughter was dead, Haley was dead, but he wanted to believe that she was out there, he could rescue her and bring her home because it appeals to the emotions. We look at the behavioral analysis. If Isabel had been taken and kidnapped into the sex trade, that mother would have been right in front of that microphone within 10 minutes pleading for her return. There would have been an urgency. The fact that they were resigned, that she was dead, they spoke of her as if she was dead, and they had no motivation to do anything about it. The charade that they're working on now is very low-key, and they go out and have a little PR game and that sort of thing. Maybe they can make some money off it or something like that, but there was no urgency. I mean, people that when their child goes missing, they lose their minds, but the adrenaline rushes. I always like to point to Desiree Young, the mother of missing 7-year-old Kyron Holman, who went missing on June 4th, I think 2010, so it's been 2 years now, where she just immediately did everything she could, including getting the family in there and taking polygraphs. And then when the sister-in-law failed the polygraph, everything turned around, and Terry Holman had obviously made some deceptive statements and lied to the police, and I believe that she killed the boy and disposed of his body. Well, in this case, if the child had been kidnapped into the sex trade, the parents would not have had a deceptive 911 call, for instance. They would not have had no motivation to go and find her. So, no, it's not viable. It's not a plausible thing.
Oh, well, and you know, I'll tell you, the talking about the Casey Anthony, Kaylee Anthony, Cindy Anthony situation. That was such a that was one of the cases. Periodically, I really get into a case heavy, and that was one of the ones I really got, you know, followed. And of course, they had the. I was intrigued by Casey, I guess, and how she could tell these lies. Seemingly, they just rolled off her tongue, and I really got involved in that, and I was. I had mixed emotions about the whole family because I sensed myself that I didn't trust Cindy and what she was doing and, you know, leading up to the trial and everything about these press, not necessarily press conferences, but she'd come out of the house. And, of course, there was always reporters and cameras and telling people, oh, I know she's alive, I can feel it and all that stuff. And I was wondering if that was a sabotage move in motion.
It was. It was. In fact, she slipped up. She said, I know that Kaylee's not in the woods or anything. And no one had said specifically she was in the woods. And that led people to know. And she, of course, sent her private investigator to the area. He almost found the body himself. She knew even where to look. So she perjured herself. She lied deliberately. She was sabotaging and destroying the investigation. But she was clever enough. And the prosecution was, I think, weak in not prosecuting her for perjury, but she was clever enough to taint the jury pool by telling people, even as the ashes were worn around her neck, that Kaylee was still alive and living in Brooklyn with Zanny the nanny. And it wasn't just illness. It was manipulative. Her statement showed deception. Deception, in order to be seen, must be willful. If I'm nuts and believe I'm Santa Claus, my language will be truthful. But when I know that I'm lying, that I'm not Santa Claus, my language will show deception. Cindy Anthony was consistent in deception almost from day one. Almost from day one.
Peter, I just looked and we just got logged off of the live stream. Time flew. So we'll have to wind her down. Peter, thanks so much for coming on again tonight. And we'll be working together again in the future, I'm sure.
Thanks for having me, Denny.
Appreciate it. And thanks to the Crime Wire team, Director of Research Kim Colton, and Public Relations team at Image and Publicity. Our next show will be on Tuesday, September 4th. Remember, we ensure that your voices will be heard when there is nowhere else to turn. Visit our website, www.crimewiresite.com. God bless from the Crime Wire team. Denny Griffin and Susan Murphy Milano, thank you and good night.